This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatto on Science Friday as the talk turns to the preservation of the genetic information of endangered plants and animals and from seed banks to frozen zoos. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Now there's news coming out of the State Department today that North Korea may have agreed to six-way talks on the issue of ending its nuclear weapons program. Although no date or place for those talks has been named, this is the first encouraging development for quite a while in the high-stakes standoff between North Korea and the Bush administration over the communist nation's nuclear ambitions. While tensions simmer in capitals throughout the region, the front line in this battle of wills is the 155-mile border between the two Koreas, a region few people get to visit, much less travel around. For the cover story in the July issue of National Geographic magazine, senior writer Tom O'Neill joined the troops along the DMZ and even spent a few days as a tourist north of the border. He's with us now here in Studio 3A to talk about what he saw. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. Good to be here.
If you have questions about the on-the-ground situation around the demilitarized zone, join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Tom, the DMZ is, despite its name, perhaps the most heavily defended part of anywhere on the planet.
You know, it is, but it's right behind the DMZ, a huge military base, has the finest equipment, most advanced helicopters, gunships. But the DMZ by itself, I kept thinking it was like coming to a city in dawn at 6 a.m. because actually, the border is almost empty. It's guys on patrol, it's fences, it's open fields and guard towers. And that is what's so eerie about it. It's backed up by two of the largest armies in the world. But the actual DMZ is like an old-fashioned, almost medieval standoff, people on patrols, on foot, binoculars, so forth. And it's a strange disjunction to see that.
To my surprise, everybody's familiar with the name, at least, of Panmunjom, the armistice village that's in the DMZ. I didn't know there were two other villages in the DMZ.
Yes, in fact, that's what most people see of North Korea if they're tourists and come up to Panmunjom, which they can actually do, and they see a North Korean village, and people get so excited, and then you look closer, and no one's living in it. The windows are empty. It's a Potemkin village. It's a propaganda village, they call it. The South Village is a propaganda village, too. They put farmers in there with the biggest farms in South Korea. They live with a curfew. They're under armed guard as they're harvesting their rice. But they're there as a symbolic force. And I'll tell you, the DMZ is full of symbols. It's this war of propaganda when you get that close. Electronic billboards blasting from the south side, music and slogans coming from the north. The South Koreans are chosen to be a certain height. The U.S. soldiers have to be 6 feet, most of them that serve right up there. It is all the flagpole on the North Korean side is the tallest in the world. It's 52 stories tall, and it's just part of this chest-beating macho symbolism because they can't have their heavy arms in the DMZ. That's why it is demilitarized. Only handguns, rifles. And yet they're, yeah, so they try these other things to go, I'm better, I'm bigger, I'm tougher. And so in that way, yeah, it's, someone called it a playground battle between bullies, and it felt like that a little bit.
Surreal is one of the words that comes to mind. I mean, for one thing, if those billboards and the music, if that's going to get anywhere, that's got to be one big billboard, and the music's got to be pretty loud.
It is. That was my first introduction to the DMZ. I'm on an armed patrol. They agreed, the UN forces agreed to take me to the front line, and that's what I heard, this music and this shrill voices, and it was from these giant speakers. Any rock concert would love to have them, but you could hear them from miles away, and it was Americans go home, life is better here, so forth. And so it's noisy in that way. In fact, that morning it was so noisy, hundreds of ducks were flying around. They couldn't get settled because so much noise. And it's a big wetland right there around Panmunjom. And so there's a lot of wildlife. And I wondered what they thought, because they must feel they're in the middle of a city with all this blaring noise.
Well, one of the things you write about is that inadvertently, this natural preserve, wildland preserve, has been created.
Yes, and that was the other surprise to me, other than this kind of symbol bluffing, is how actually beautiful the DMZ is. A lot of it looked like the Smoky Mountains to me. I think 3/4 of the DMZ is in mountains, rugged valleys, and so forth. And then they have these floodplains that the geese come from, come from China. 3 rare species. I mostly saw the red crown, and they're beautiful. They feed on the rice left over on the harvested field. And the reason they're all coming to South Korea is that in the rice fields in North Korea, they remove every kernel of rice because they need it so much, so there's nothing for the cranes to pick over. So the eastern waste, the cranes are benefiting by. But it was beautiful to see them fly, because I'd spent day after day with men in uniforms and followed. I was embedded in that world, and seeing the cranes did offer a different vision of that place, though it seems a long way off.
Tell us about a man you met by the name of Lim Sun Nam.
Yes. As part of my story for the National Geographic, I tried to find other ways to cover it than just the military. And I looked for the environmental side. And he was a man that used to be a television reporter that got fascinated by that tigers still lived in the mountains. And tigers are a very potent symbol for Koreans. And they've all thought to be wiped out. And he has been this one-man band where he will put traps up, cameras, go out, camp in the mountains. And I went out with him for several days, and he showed me where he'd seen all the tigers, where they shredded the trees. He showed me, or introduced me to people that had heard them and said they saw them. And no official believes him, but he, in the middle of that wildness, and it is wild out there in those mountains, he had me convinced just that a wild animal could live here, because it's safe if you don't step on a landmine.
I was just going to say, if you don't step, this is heavily mined.
It is. A lot of part of it, but I got to believe the game trails in the last 50 years have figured that out, if there are tigers. And one funny thing on landmines, when I was with UN troops there, the UN command, they'd be seen around at night, and if they'd hear a landmine go off, they'd go, oh, there's another three-legged deer. That's just that kind of surreal nature where that's just part of life. So they assume that, yeah, the wildlife's having a hard time, too.
Email question we have from Phil Sullivan in Greenville, North Carolina. How wide is the DMZ, and what sparks the occasional exchange of gunfire between the two sides?
Well, it's only 2.5 miles wide, so each side only has 1.25 miles, and the fences come in different places. What sparks it is, I'm amazed there's so little gunfire for 50 years, because they're so tense and they dislike each other. But I think it would be people. I think on the north, I heard stories that as part of their coming of age or initiation, they would have to sneak across and go to an old graveyard or steal something from the other side. And I would think that's when the shots would come. But again, you know, once you get past the DMZ, there are all these army bases, and they wouldn't get far. So actually, only 1,000 people have died in 50 years in skirmishes, and it could be that in a day with how heavily armed they are behind. So there's amazing discipline on both sides, because they realize mistakes would bring in possibly China, Japan, South Korea, U.S. So, there aren't a lot of cowboys up there. They're kept on a pretty tight leash.
We're speaking with Tom O'Neill, a writer for National Geographic, about his recent visit to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas, for National Geographic. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller. Becky joins us now on the line from St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Becky.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk about my experience of being able to visit Panmunjom in 1972.
That was quite some time ago. Yes. What was it like?
Well, it was a very interesting place. I had the opportunity to study some geography when I was in college, and I think one of the things that was very striking is as a location that is a border experience, I think that's probably one of the most striking I have ever been in. I was able to ride a tourist bus from Seoul up to Panmunjom, and one of the things we were shown through was the building where the armistice was signed. And there's, you know, an electric cord running down the middle of this table to a microphone that actually marks the division between North and South Korea right at that point in that room.
In your article, Tom, you write that there's a concrete strip right through the middle.
Yes, and I wanted to tell the caller in my story, a lot has happened in that hut over the years as they try to meet periodically, and there's a lot of psychological warfare, and in the past people have cut the legs off of chairs so one side seems smaller, and again the eye duels that they have that you probably saw, where it's the one place on that demarcation line where the South Korean and U.S. troops come within a couple feet of the North, and
yes,
just glare at each other, and it's...
Yes, there were guards from both sides in the room when we were there.
Yeah, and they try to provoke each side, and it's amazing theater, and I think the reason tourists go up there, the South says they're telling the North, look, we're not afraid, we can bring tourists in and let them see everything, but I have to admit, I did see Chinese tourists on the other side, too, so it's... I guess there's a lot of propaganda going on up
there. One of the things that was very noticeable is something you commented on earlier. When our tourist bus arrived from Seoul, all of the American guards who were there who came up to salute the bus were tall enough to look in the windows of the bus. And there was no American soldier that we saw who was any shorter than 6 feet, and most of them are much taller than that.
You're right. I mean, they're big. And even for us, we were told we couldn't wear jeans as visitors. We could not let the North see jeans as if that's a symbol of a slacker or an impoverished land. So we had to wear our khakis. Yes.
The other thing that was very striking is it's almost the only place attached to South Korea that was not deforested in 1972. I don't know what the rest of the country is like now. But
you know, you're right. The veterans that have come back that I met said, man, it's a jungle out here, because they did see it denuded. And even into the 70s, I understood. But it's, second or third growth forest.
Right. I think the other thing that was deforesting it is the traditional way to heat the houses. You have this big, tall, cylindrical charcoal brick that gets lowered into a burner that's outside the house.
Yeah.
And I presume that a lot of that charcoal making is part of what deforested.
Yeah, and they want to keep the sight lines clean, too, so that's why they're cutting a lot down.
Oh, no, I meant the rest of South Korea.
Oh, the whole of Korea, you're right. Oh, I thought buildings
DMZ
took the place of everything.
Strikingly, that's what made me realize that South Korea probably had a forest, is when I got into the DMZ and saw what's there.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Just a very fascinating place on the earth.
Yeah.
Becky, thanks very much for the call.
You're very welcome.
Quick email question from Dale Jones. Are the tunnels under the DMZ still in existence, or have they been filled in?
You know, that's, if you are a tourist, there are not many places you can go. You can go to Panmunjom, but you can go to four tunnels, and they're fascinating. It's like going into a coal mine, and you can see how they've been dug by hand and by the North Koreans, and they go deep under the DMZ into the south. And I guess they were dug for invasions, and they believe that there are dozens that haven't been found yet.
Tom O'Neill, a senior writer with National Geographic magazine, thanks very much for joining us here in Studio 3A.
It was fun. Thank you.
If you would like to learn more about his trip to the Demilitarized Zone, visit our website at npr.org and go to the Talk of the Nation page, where you'll find a photo and a link to his article. And that brings us to the first of our goodbyes today. Today we say goodbye to our senior online editor and web producer, Kara Fogarty. When Talk of the Nation tells you to go to the web, it's often because of her that what we say is there is actually there. She leaves NPR tomorrow for a much-deserved summer break and starts teaching college courses in the fall. Kara, good luck and thank you. And we can stop trying to figure out which languages Amelia Shaw does not speak. You may remember hearing our well-educated intern's performance in the role of an Italian waitress, and, well, you may get to hear her again as a reporter after she takes her Fulbright and heads off to Haiti. Thanks, Amelia, et bonne chance. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.